From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The newspapers of Baghdad, says Guardian columnist Salam Pax, are like the famous bread of Bab al-Aga, hot, crispy, and cheap. One, he writes, is even published by a pastry salesman. The Jordanian paper Al-Arab Al-Yam reported that more than 60 papers have appeared, up from 5 during Saddam's reign. Everyone seems to have a voice in Baghdad. Of course, some voices are louder than others. For example, the U.S.-led occupation force, which is currently devising a code of conduct for the press. Mike Furlong, a senior advisor to the Provisional Coalition Authority, told the AP that, quote, there's no room for hateful and destabilizing messages that will destroy the emerging Iraqi democracy. But U.S. officials there say there will be no attempt to block criticism of the occupation. NPR's Deb Amos joins us now from Baghdad. Deb, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks, Brooke, and that number's up. It's somewhere around, a little over 100 newspapers now that are on the street.
Wow. Who's publishing them?
Everybody. For example, I went the other day to the Office of the Independent Iraqi Political Prisoners, and they have a newspaper that's named after the day that George Bush ended the war. They have news and a variety of things, and on their front page every day they have a story from one of the prisoners that recounts the experiences of them in prison. There's political cartoons in that paper. The one that people read more than any is one that would be translated into the Times. El Zaman. It was published for a long time out of London, and it was an old Minister of Information employee who parted company with Saddam and moved to London. That paper is the most professional looking of any of them. It has pictures of starlets on the back page, because I see them when we're driving down the street. And they have the most up-to-date Iraqi news.
Now, among all of these newspapers, are there some that seem to be snapped up from the stands more than others?
Well, people don't have money right now. So what you see are Iraqis standing in front of newsstands reading them, but not buying them. And the reason you can have so many right now is there's no licenses required. There's no law about it, so anybody can start one.
And what do they look like? Are they mimeographed, 8x10 pages? Are they broadsheets? Are they tabloids as we know them here?
Also, the same variety. I mean, a couple of days ago, we saw one that was a mimeograph sheet, and there was a picture of Saddam on it, so we were interested enough to go and buy it. And it was a story about one of Saddam's lookalikes who was an electricity worker, and if you can imagine what kind of shock people must have been in when he showed up at the front door. Others are quite professional, color photographs. The one that's coming in from London looks like that. But they also run the gamut from the quite professional to essentially the handwritten copy on the side of the street.
Has it invigorated the marketplace of ideas? Does this reflect a genuine diversity, I guess I want to ask, in Baghdad?
I think so, but there's also some dangers to that. There was a newspaper last week that reported that some U.S. soldiers had raped a young woman in one of the neighborhoods here. And that caused quite a stir. CENTCOM went out of its way to put on its own website that they had investigated thoroughly. This was an incident that did not happen. And that's a worrying kind of reporting here because it can stir up the population. It's a very, very sensitive topic. So there's no laws against incitement yet. Nothing that has come out of the U.S. occupying forces. They are talking about making an incitement law to be able to shut down newspapers that print hate speech against other ethnic groups, wild rumors, but it's not in place yet.
I guess this is the press code that the Allied force is currently working on. So principally, they're worried about hate speech. But when you start talking about incitement, that can cover a wide variety of political expression. And as we've heard so often, part of this effort is to extend our democratic principles abroad. The minute you start developing a code, don't you walk into a quagmire?
Well, worse than that, Brooke, the courts are really not operating. Lawyers aren't able to function. All the ways that we understand those kind of laws, they can't function here because the rest of the institutional backup isn't there either. I think that the coalition forces want to encourage free speech, but they are finding out themselves that after 30 years of one-man rule here, Iraqis are having a little trouble figuring out what exactly freedom is. So that's why you are seeing such a cacophony of voices and people testing out what exactly you're allowed to put out on the street.
Deb Amos, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Deb Amos is in Baghdad reporting for National Public Radio.
In the weeks leading up to the American invasion of Iraq, pundits and market analysts filled many column inches speculating on what the war would mean for oil prices here at home. In their view, the situation would be compounded by the turmoil in Venezuela, where a two-month strike had paralyzed the oil industry. Those fears may have subsided, but Venezuela's fading from the headlines does not mean that all is well there. The country's economy is in free fall. If you read the Venezuelan press, there's no doubt who's to blame, President Hugo Chavez. But if you're an American, the picture is a little murkier. Joining us to look at the divergence in these two stories is Francisco Toro, the political editor of Ben Economy, a business magazine based in Caracas. Francisco, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
In the last year, among your other journalistic enterprises, you've been running an anti-Chavezista web blog. And at some point, this came into conflict with your work as a stringer at the New York Times. You ended up resigning from the New York Times. Tell me about that decision.
Yeah, I think resigning is a strong word. It implies that I had been unstaffed, which I hadn't been. I stopped stringing for them. Essentially, I would not describe my blog as an anti-Chavez blog. There's a lot to be critical of on both sides. I was trying to give foreign readers an insider's view of political reality here that was very frank. The problem with that is that being very frank in a situation like this does come into conflict clearly with the very strict standards on impartiality that a paper like the New York Times has.
Just before you stopped working for the Times, you wrote in your blog, quote, "The Venezuelan media and the foreign press corps are caught in a spiral of mutual misunderstanding and mistrust." First, what did you mean? And secondly, are the problems still there?
What I meant is that the Venezuelan press can't understand at all why the foreign newspapers don't report on Venezuelan news in the way that they do, which is starting from the baseline assumption that the government is deeply authoritarian. To those of us who live here 24 hours a day and who have to listen to the president speak several times a week, this seems to us blindingly clear. And it's very difficult for them to understand why the foreign newspapers continue to report on Chavez as though he were more or less a normal politician. The foreign press can't understand how the local media expect to be seen as real journalists when 99% of the material that they put on the air is clearly designed to embarrass the government.
The American media in the recent past seem to have collectively agreed that some national leaders, like Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, like Slobodan Milosevic, like Saddam Hussein, deserve titles like dictator and adjectives like oppressive. But Chavez, so far, for the most part, seems to have eluded that kind of labeling. Is there some sort of threshold that he must cross in order to assume the cloak of illegitimacy?
Well, what I would say is that Chavez has been very shrewd on his management of international perceptions of his government. He has been very careful not to make the kinds of openly oppressive or openly dictatorial moves that would clearly put him beyond the pale in the eyes of the first world media and also a first world government. But what we found out over the last few years here is that democracy doesn't necessarily die with a bang. Sometimes democracy dies with a whimper. Sometimes democracy dies with a series of encroaching parliamentary procedures that little by little strip away citizens' basic rights until one day you look around you and you no longer live in a democracy. Now, that's very much the kind of gradual process that Venezuela has undergone. But I think the foreign media is caught on, and I trust that they will react accordingly.
Well, if it's true that Chavez is inching ever closer to the, as you put it in your blog, the full Mugabe, I wonder how it will affect you and how it has affected you. Do you think that you are in any sort of danger, either physically or otherwise?
Well, I personally am not as much of a threat to the government because I'm not on the television. The government has clearly realized that the real mass medium here and the medium that creates problems for them is the TV. So my friends who work in television certainly are in danger. They're certainly harassed when they try to cover public events. Many of them have been roughed up, although not necessarily seriously, by pro-government supporters. The tenor of that kind of intimidation and harassment has also increased gradually and will probably continue to increase over time.
Well, apart from the other journalistic conflicts that are swirling in your reporting life right now, what is it like for you to be in common cause with industrial forces that are using the nation's electronic media as a blunt instrument against the elected government?
Well, it's very uncomfortable. I think in a political situation where you have two highly polarized sides facing each other off as enemies, reality becomes simplified, and realities that do not fit into the cookie-cutter ideological view of one side or the other become very uncomfortable for both sides. And so those of us who have tried to be critical, certainly of the government, but also of the opposition when the opposition makes mistakes, find ourselves under attack from both sides. Certainly the local media attacks the government in a way that is appalling, in a way that does not meet basic standards of journalistic balance. At the same time, it's very difficult for people to condemn the private media, even though their interests are clearly mercantile and corporate interests. They feel very much like if it is those interests that will stand up to a regime that does not respect basic democratic institutions and basic democratic freedoms, then, well, thank God somebody's doing it.
Francisco, thank you.
Thank you.
Francisco Toro is political editor of Ben Economy, an opposition-minded business magazine in Caracas. You can read his ruminations about the press and politics in Venezuela on his weblog, CaracasChronicles.com.
Coming up, no news is bad news in Congo, Minnesota's weather wars, and a very dirty Pulitzer Prize.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In Congo, wrote reporter Somini Semgupta in the New York Times, the problem up to now has been an absence of genocide. 4 years of war have killed more than 3 million people through displacement, starvation, and disease, as well as cold-blooded murder. But the blame is shared among all warring parties. The carnage has been mutual. Last month in the town of Bunia, UN peacekeepers stood helplessly by as warring militias hacked up babies and old men and dumped their bodies into a water tank. The international world knows it cannot sustain the stain of another Rwanda, but then it was claimed to be caught by surprise. It can't say that now. But what about the American people? Do they know what is happening, what is certain to happen? Philip Gorevich is author of We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, Stories from Rwanda, and he joins us now. Welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Okay, so over the past several weeks, the American press once again seems to have discovered the fighting in Congo. Does the coverage reflect a rise in the level of violence there?
not completely. There was a massacre of 1,000 in that region just last year. There have been killings like this periodically for some time, which have not been covered at all in the American press. Right now, there's this flare-up, and it's a flare-up where the coincidence of UN presence and UN ineffectuality in the face of killing, killings taking place under the nose of people who are supposedly there to represent our concern, that's what's making this a story right now.
So the presence of outside observers makes this a more visible story. What about news organizations themselves? Do they have many people on the ground?
No, they don't have enough people on the ground. The way Africa is covered, and I don't think many people understand this, is it's covered as if it were one place, almost. You know, there's Africa. And many places, I think NPR is one, have an African correspondent. I mean, the only way to sort of compare that is to think of an Asian correspondent or a European correspondent who's supposed to cover 27 countries in, let's say, half of which there's either a war or a definitive election taking place at any given moment. When I was covering Rwanda over the years, people would say to me, oh, look, you know, there's a series of articles. Rwanda is back in the news. But in fact, as I always said, no, the news is back in Rwanda.
Do you think African wars are treated differently from wars in other parts of the world because of their apparent intractability? And here we may have the whiff of racism. Well, we can't solve those problems.
I really don't think it's necessarily exactly racism. I think that it has to do with a kind of political imagination. In other words, Africa doesn't threaten us. It doesn't involve us. And the terrible thing is that the brutality of Africa is particularly graphic, often because the arms are relatively small arms. The killing is done with machetes, with handguns, with basically stoned kids running around with Kalashnikovs and hatchets. This is something that people basically look at and immediately say, that's insane, and nobody can give me a reason to understand it. So the failure is, if you don't cover a story like this steadily, then there's no way to describe it except by saying, you know, the words that you get when you look at the press coverage of the Congo War, a bewildering flock of incomprehensible forces with virtually indistinguishable claims. Well, that's almost like telling a reader, do not try to absorb this.
I take your point. However, if one follows coverage from the Middle East, which is the one foreign story that's covered heavily in the United States, you find that in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it seems to be an endless march of incomprehensible violence as well.
There's a certain level on which, though, one has a sense of the players. One comes to distinguish between the new prime minister and Arafat and the way that the Barak and the Paris governments approach things and the Sharon government. And these are words that I can throw out here and assume that your listeners will basically recognize who these names are. But if I tell you that the Museveni-led factions versus the Bemba factions in parts of the Congo were really unable to sit down at a table with Kabila Jr. after a while because of the way that the Kagame and the Mugabe factions were figuring, this is gibberish. And yet, it shouldn't be any more gibberish to most Americans, presumably, than what was going on in the Balkans. They knew the difference between a Mladic and a Karadzic, but they still don't know the names of the masterminds of the Rwandan genocide, even though they're on trial in UN tribunals in Arusha.
And when the public does get information from Congo, as we've heard recently, usually the specter of what happened in Rwanda is invoked. We know it's on the minds of the UN. So let me ask you whether you think Congo does present another Rwanda to the world.
Well, I think that Congo presents a Congo to the world, which is to say the situation in Congo is in and of itself deserving of the world's attention, not purely because of the example of Rwanda. The example of Rwanda was the story of a government setting out systematically to eliminate a section of its population, to exterminate a minority group. In Congo, you have the opposite. You have small groups of people involved in piecemeal killing. The quote that you read from Somini Sengupta's article in the New York Times saying the problem Congo has is that they don't have genocide is precisely that if one says, well, is this another Rwanda? The answer technically is no. And therefore, people can say, well, we don't have to deal with it.
But what about the role of public opinion? I mean, one of the reasons why we did go into Somalia, how disastrous that may have been, is because the American people were shocked and horrified by the pictures that they saw and the stories that they read. If the media coverage of Congo were stepped up, would that prompt action?
Africa is not a priority. It's not a priority for the government. It's not a priority for the business community. It's not an economic priority. And it's not a press priority. I mean, you cannot be constantly on top of every misery on earth. how are you supposed to cover the war in Liberia and the war in Congo and the situation in Sudan, which, by the way, hasn't gotten any better since you last heard about it, and the situation in Ethiopia and Eritrea, and the situation in Ivory Coast, which is dreadful, and the sort of happier story of the somewhat improved aftermath of the Sierra Leone war so that people aren't totally discouraged, and the completely difficult story to unravel of what's been going on in Angola of late. And then what about Zimbabwe? So my problem is, you know, on the one hand, I do think that a great deal more could be covered about these things, but I think that one should be cautious about sort of assuming that in an ideal world, everything would be covered equally. Because one thing I can say is, if you want to know about what's going on in these places, the internet has become a tremendous service. It's available. And the fact is, most people don't feel like it's something that they actually are being deprived of. It's painful, but true.
Okay. Philip Gorevich, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Philip Gorevich is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and is author of the book about the 1994 genocide in Rwanda called We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families.
Jason Blair was a nightmare of a journalist, but his sins probably didn't significantly alter the course of world history. Another New York Times correspondent in a different time, in a different place, may have. This is the story of a scandal that has been hidden in plain view for 70 years, reemerging to bedevil the staggered New York Times. Pulitzer Prize winner Walter Duranty, the Times' Moscow correspondent in the late 1920s and early 30s, accused then and now of suppressing the story of millions of Ukrainians dying from famine, may now have his Pulitzer posthumously revoked in response to an international campaign. Bert Patnaud wrote about Duranty in his new book, The Big Show in Bolo Land. He joins me now on the phone from his home in California. Bert, welcome to On the Media.
Good to be here.
Gossip about the integrity of Duranty's reporting swirled 7 decades ago. Why did he get the Pulitzer in the first place, and why is the Pulitzer Board now considering revoking the prize?
Well, he got the Pulitzer in 1932 primarily for his reporting on Stalin's crash industrialization of the first five-year plan. Well, what started to happen in 1932 was that you had a major famine breakout in Ukraine. Now, reporting the famine, if Duranty had done it faithfully, would actually have made not just the Soviet Union look bad, but Duranty look bad, because this great narrative about the great Soviet achievement would have been punctured.
So actually he was being boosterish about Stalin's industrialization.
Very much so, to the point where in 1932, on September 16, he published a long, shall we call it a poem, it's an ode to Red Square, and in there he says, this is 1932, this is before the famine begins, he says, Russians may be hungry and short of clothes and comfort, but you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. Now, that phrase happened to be the way Stalin justified the number of deaths that accompanied the great industrialization drive. But here is Duranty repeating it and praising it in the New York Times.
We're talking about millions of deaths and what has been described by some historians as Stalin's genocide against his own people, an intentional famine, in other words. And some of that was reported contemporaneously. Duranty wasn't the only Western reporter stationed in the Soviet Union. What of the other reporters on the scene at the time? Didn't they talk about the famine?
Well, they began to talk about it in 1933. There is always the issue of whether you would be kicked out if you told the actual story. But some of them did. One of them was Malcolm Muggeridge, British correspondent. And he actually, after he came out, shortly after writing articles about the famine, condemned Duranty for covering it up. Now, it's not as if Duranty never spoke about a problem, but he never used the word famine.
Muggeridge was not shy about criticizing Duranty. He called him a sociopath. Those are strong words. Why, in the intervening 7 decades, has this extraordinary sin of omission, at a minimum, not gotten the attention of the Pulitzer Board? Why did it take the current difficulties at the New York Times to bring this issue to the surface?
I mean, the Times has done enough on this, it seems to me. The newsroom has an equivalent of an asterisk by Duranty's Pulitzer. I mean, it seems to me that's as far as they can go. Now the issue is whether the Pulitzer Board will feel the pressure. And it comes from a couple of sources. One is, as you say, the Times is very vulnerable at this moment. This is a moment when the box is open, so to speak. But I would say that, look, the Ukrainians, who I have been pushing for this for a long time, are in a much better position now because since the end of the Cold War, and in particular, recently, people are openly comparing the Soviet Union to Nazi Germany. And I think the moment has been reached now when it's no longer taboo to make those comparisons, not to say that they were the same, but at least to make the comparisons. I think that has created the atmosphere that's going to cause some trouble for the Pulitzer Board.
Well, Bert, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob. My pleasure.
Bert Patnaud is a historian at Stanford University and author of The Big Show in Bolo Land, a history of American relief of the first Soviet famine.
Minnesota is legendary for its fierce winters and equally fierce obsession with weather. It's a place where idle chats about wind chill can bloom into full-fledged debates and where a meteorologist can easily claim 10 minutes of a 25-minute broadcast. It was a rough winter this past year in Minnesota, but even if it weren't, the coverage would be huge because it is Minnesota, and without the weather, well, there is no without weather in Minnesota. So if the media can't report on actual storms, they'll just tell you what might happen during a storm. On the Media's Sarah Lemanchik has been tracking the weathermen.
This spring, you can't turn on the TV in Minneapolis-St. Paul without finding a meteorologist concerned about your safety. His concern is usually flanked by lots of fake thunder, and in the case of Channel 5, his concern is voiced over blue-gray images of a young family cowering under an umbrella.
The average person wouldn't see this storm coming. Neither would the average radar. Now with SkyMax 5, the only million-watt radar in the Twin Cities, Dave Dahl shows you the storms other radars miss. Unmatched experience with radar. And now a million watts of power.
Million watts, that's a lot of watts. Of course, Channel 4 says that they have the best weather technology on the planet.
The bottom line is, we have amazing technology, but we've combined that with experience. Who's been tracking storms the longest? Not just years, but decades of finding the storms. What do they mean? Where are they going? How dangerous are they going to be? You don't get that overnight in a piece of equipment. You build that up over decades. Technology and experience, we have that on four.
Technology, experience, I like that. That sounds good. I'm not sure if it's better than 1 million watts. But here's the basic question. Why do local stations spend all this time and money hawking the weather? I tracked down Dave Dahl, chief meteorologist at Channel 5 in St. Paul, and wielder of the new million-watt SkyMax 5.
It has helped our ratings, and I think the overall goal is to not only get more people to watch, but of course keep more people safe. And severe weather, we haven't had a lot of severe weather yet, so I believe that'll be the first real telltale sign. If we can get a lot of people to watch us when we do get severe weather, then it will be a winner.
Sure. In a perfect world, it's a win-win. You get the number one slot in the ratings war, and everybody emerges safely from their basement after the storm has passed.
Storms tend to hide where most radars can't find them, like behind other storms.
But is fake thunder really the best tactic?
Yeah, I don't want to be scary. We did want to pique people's interest. I mean, the whole idea of the ad was to get them interested in what we were going to do and want to see this new technology that we're coming out with. So the scary part, I don't totally agree with, but the fact that they do catch people's interest, that's the whole idea.
On a pleasant, sunny afternoon, I met Brian Lambert, media columnist for the St. Paul Pioneer Press, at a local coffee shop.
Weather has the aura of being legitimate. I mean, this has a community service aspect. It's not, it's not exploiting violence or anything else. So in that way, it looks like, a kind of a clean promotional slate for them.
Unlike sweeps-induced panic about teen prostitution, the weather is real every day. And that fact lulls our skepticism to sleep, at least long enough for us to believe that promos that run 4 or 5 times a day could really be about our safety. Dave Dahl.
When we first installed the Doppler, I was working here, And we used to talk about the Doppler radar can stop everything. It was the way we promoted it. But we made it sound like it was going to stop all severe weather. The day after a tornado struck in Roseville, a woman called me up, and she was crying on the phone. And she said, why did you let that tornado hit my house? She said, you have the Doppler radar. And I felt so bad that we had made people believe that because we have a Doppler radar, we can actually stop weather. We can't stop it, but we're able to see it now in advance.
Doppler, radar, live storm tracking. It's exciting, dramatic terminology, the type of thing you'd tune in for even if you weren't sure what it meant. Again, Brian Lambert.
It is a great gimmick for them, and it is, you know, for whatever the reasons, if it's true or not, but for whatever the reasons, you know, Minnesotans love this stuff. They love being in touch with it. I guess it's some kind of a link to our agrarian past, you know, when our inner farmer or something.
It's true. Here in Minnesota, we love the weather. We even make our meteorologists stand outside while they give us the forecast, so we can kind of live the weather with them right at that moment. And the networks rely on our voracious appetite for all things atmospheric. The result this spring is a very public battle for the hearts and minds of Minnesota, with meteorologists accusing each other of bravado or downright incompetence. It's a battle that Dave Dahl takes personally. In fact, he gets a little emotional about it.
When they start to mention our radar and our station on their air, it's great. It's great promotion for us because it does then tell people, hey, maybe we should tune to Channel 5 because they have something that this guy thinks is too strong. Well, if it's too powerful, what's too powerful? I mean, if it can actually show us more, how can that be too powerful?
All this power, all this radar, all these ads, whether or not there's any weather to report.
The only thing showing up in the metro, believe it or not, are some controlled burns. We actually have some brush fires, and the Doppler radar is so sensitive that it can actually pick up, in this case, plumes of smoke.
So even if the skies are peaceful, weather is still the biggest and most expensive gun in the local television ratings war, and they're not about to stop shooting, even if they're just blowing smoke. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Lemanchek.
Otherwise, a little bit of ground clutter showing up, a dry scan, and that's the way it's
coming up. Goodbye to a wry news guy. TV after TiVo and music videos that overturn the social order.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A quiet Southerner with a dry wit and a heaven-sent appreciation of brevity has stolen the television limelight this week at the Democratic National Convention. That was Jack Gould, the New York Times television critic, writing on August 17, 1956. Mr. Brinkley, he wrote, quite possibly could be the forerunner of a new school of television commentator.
On January 2nd, Fidel Castro gave us another exercise in the modern art form talk fact. That is, say something is a fact because you wish it were. He said the imperialists, meaning us, of course, had been defeated all over Latin America.
He died Wednesday from complications from a fall, ABC News reported, at the age of 82. When he stepped down as host of This Week with David Brinkley in November of 96, he'd been the anchor or host of a TV news show for 40 years, longer than anyone ever had. I watched the Huntley Brinkley Report with my parents when I was a little kid. In fact, I was a little startled the first time I saw David Brinkley in color. He used to fascinate me even when I was in the single digits because, as the reviewer said, his style was so laconic and so dry. There was always the palpable presence of an absence, all the things he chose not to say. Ab Weston is a veteran of network news, and you've worked on and off with David Brinkley, haven't you?
I did, and I competed against him on a number of occasions, and you're absolutely right. This is a brand new style. It was folksier, in fact, than we were sort of used to. Broadcast news originally was cast in the mode of Murrow and the rather stentorian tones, and I used to say that news was defined by Murrow's definition, and if it wasn't geopolitical, it didn't have a place on the air, and Brinkley clearly broke that mold.
Do you remember watching the Huntley Brinkley Report?
I was working at CBS News at the time, and I will tell you that we watched that team rapidly supplant CBS News as the major audience getter.
He beat the pants off you guys.
Well, that's a way of putting it.
Veteran TV news producer Ab Weston. When the three networks ruled, anchors could have a huge impact on the way people saw the world. Brinkley spoke not from on high, but with feet firmly planted in the soil. It's his skeptical take on the powerful, even more than his wit, that is sorely missed on the small screen today.
What if there were a magical machine to rid the world of this?
Hey, this is Carousel reminding you, if you're going to make a collect call, pick up the phone and dial 1-800-C-A-L-L-A-T-T.
1-800-C-A-L-L-A-T-T.
Nice job, Carrot Stick.
That, of course, is the walking, talking earache known as Carrot Top. In an ad campaign that makes 25 cackling years of Madge the Palmolive manicurist seem, relatively speaking, like sipping white wine in the hot tub. But here's the thing. There is a miracle anti-Carrot Top machine. It's called TiVo, a personal video recorder, or PVR, that among many other wonderful features enables users to obliterate anything deemed objectionable, obnoxious, or simply obstructive of the program viewing experience. In other words, the advertising. Indeed, studies show that those who own TiVo or similar devices skip past 55 to 80% of all TV commercials.
We are going to witness tectonic change in television over the next 5 to maybe 8 years on the outside.
David Verklin is CEO of Cara North America, a media buying company that commands billions of dollars in TV ad spending.
The PVR technology will become ubiquitous. So, what happens when everybody has a hard drive on top of their television, which A, lets them watch what they want to watch, when they want to watch it, and allows them to fast forward TV commercials? I think it's going to change the way we all watch television, and I think it's going to make the 30-second TV commercial, as we currently know it, be an endangered species.
Don't be too quick to applaud. Commercials are often an irritant, but they've also almost entirely underwritten television programming for more than 5 decades. They pay for American Idol. They pay for the Super Bowl. They paid for Seinfeld and Uncle Mildy. They paid for the coverage of the Iraq War, of the Army-McCarthy hearings, of the Kennedy assassinations. Television is among the most transforming forces in human history, all brought to you by your sponsor. But the paradigm is fixing to shift, whether the advertising media complex is ready or not.
These technologies are on the horizon, but no one is paying too much attention to it at the moment.
Chuck Ross is publisher and editorial director of Television Week magazine.
There are some people, obviously, that always lead the clarion call. There's Jamie Kellner, who's head of the WB, who says that if something isn't done about TiVo, that it's almost a problem of national interest. But Jamie is definitely in the minority. Most television executives, most executives on Madison Avenue are reactive. They're not proactive. and things are going swimmingly right now, and that's all they're looking at.
Things would appear to be going swimmingly for the networks. The recent upfront buying season, in which the year's advertising contracts are negotiated, was the most lucrative in history, despite PVR fast-forwarding, despite the steady drop in audience sizes, and despite growth in satellite TV, DVD players, the internet, and digital cables, video on demand. This bizarre boom before the storm, combined with the FCC's relaxation of ownership limits, has some media companies salivating for TV station acquisitions. But what happens when reality, or at least technology, sets in? Rob Keneally, a former executive with TiVo's competitor Replay TV, is a packaging agent with the Creative Artists Agency in Beverly Hills.
I don't believe that advertisers are ultimately going to continue to pay more and get less. And devices like PVRs make it tricky for the existing advertising model to exist.
At the moment, PVRs are in only about 1.5% of TV households. TiVo as a business is struggling because the consumer stampede that was predicted at its introduction never materialized. Consumer resistance may have to do with price or fear of new gadgetry. It has nothing to do, however, with the underlying technology, which needn't be in a standalone unit like TiVo to revolutionize viewing habits. Rob Keneally.
It's going to be in the next television sets being manufactured by Sony and other. It's going to be in the PlayStation. It's already being offered in, as you know, set-top box and cable services. And as it has several entry points to the home, the distribution will grow rapidly.
Whereupon all hell could break loose, although with what outcome, nobody is certain. If the economic model for TV networks is poised to change or even collapse, one wonders what function free over-the-air TV stations will even have in a decade or two. Some cockeyed pessimists are proposing scrapping free TV for digital pay video on demand, distributed not by networks but by cable and satellite operators or internet service providers, with the TV broadcast spectrum auctioned off to the wireless telecom industry for hundreds of billions of dollars. Others believe the current model can be tinkered with to adapt to technology. Media buyer Verklin, for instance, imagines PVRs being marshaled with their interactive capabilities to target narrow receptive audiences with welcome messages based on demographics and viewing habits. Think denture adhesive.
All of a sudden, if you're the brand manager on Polygrip, you have something you've always dreamed of, just the toothless.
Others believe the solution is to seamlessly integrate programming content with commercial messages, just like they did in the golden age of television.
Just call for Philip Morris, king size or regular. Buy him by the carton. You're gonna love him, and we're gonna love you.
Hey, what was that for?
You said it so beautifully.
Good night, everybody.
See you next week.
Of course, that was also the era of whites-only drinking fountains, of the Cold War, of the cha-cha. Things change, and there's no reason to assume the viewing public is nostalgic for the heavy-handed product-pitching ways of the bad old days. This may explain why ABC's innovative product-laced Push Nevada and WB's innovative product-laced No Boundaries were instant flops. It may well be that the PVR revolution will not leave blood on the streets in the next year or even five. James Rutherford, executive vice president of the media merchant bank Veronis Sular Stevenson, believes that the existing model will hold up for at least a decade to come and is advising none of his clients to rush out and dump their broadcast holdings. On the other hand, he loves his TiVo.
I missed the Super Bowl because I was traveling and was able to watch the whole Super Bowl in about 45 minutes.
Let me see if I got this right. You fast-forwarded through the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
The number one television commercial venue in the world. You missed all the commercials.
This year, I'm afraid I did.
When trying to track a society in flux, we generally look to the arts, what the novelists are writing, what painters are depicting, and what styles they use to express what they feel. But Charles Paul Freund, senior editor of Reason magazine, suggests that pop culture is a better yardstick for measuring change. His case in point, the rise of Arab music videos. Take the one featuring dancer Haifa Webe. Wearing a rain-soaked ensemble, she stares into the camera with a sultry expression. Here, it's cheesecake of the Victoria's Secret variety, but there, it's revolutionary. Charles Paul Freund is here to deconstruct the videos. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here, Brooke.
So, describe in general what you've seen happening in Arab music videos. What's new?
There's a lot of extraordinarily interesting erotic work that's going on there. There's a lot of very interesting identity change work that's going on. There's a lot of interesting excess that some people might not expect to find. I mean, don't forget that these things are shown to more than just a self-selected audience. For example, the 6 o'clock news may conclude at 6:42, so you've got 18 minutes to kill, and part of the way you fill the time is by running these videos, so that you can make the assumption that almost everybody has seen at least some of these things.
What do you think has been the most influential video of the genre so far?
Well, probably Alyssa's has set what appears to be a new extreme for what's permissible.
Alyssa is performing a song called I Shylock, which means I live for you. Could you describe basically what's going on and what you think the significance is?
The lyrics that you heard are a pretty straightforward courtship song. It's about a woman enthralled with a man. But the visuals present a narrative about a woman who's having a liaison with a man in a Paris hotel room. And in the course of the video, most of the visuals are devoted to her own perceptions, soaked in eroticism, both of the relationship and of herself, so that you see her in various states of undress, as she imagines herself possibly, and you see her with the man who is both there and not there in various shots, and you are invited to play the part of Alyssa's lover as she stares into the camera, into our eyes, with a great deal of erotic intensity. And the song itself, as you hear, is actually a very catchy part of the disco throwback that's actually quite popular now in the Middle East.
Now, would people here say, oh, well, she's being objectified, or is she defining her own sexuality?
I would argue that if you look at all of these videos, the various women singers are all using their sexuality to establish the limits of how far they can be pushed by the increasingly puritanical forces of Islamism, which are at play in the region. If this were not a period of rising Islamism, one could make an argument that this is just more coquettishness that sells.
Now, Alyssa is Christian. Many of the women in these videos are Christian. You do mention one Muslim singer, Samir, who is dressed modestly throughout her video and yet conveys a powerful sexual message.
That's actually a wonderful video. Although she's, in fact, modestly dressed and she moves with decorum, the way in which she presents a song about her anticipation of her marriage and her wedding night and what she does with her body movement and what she does with her face, she's essentially inviting the audience to share her anticipated pleasure. That's actually a particularly pleasing video and in many ways an astonishing one.
Now, you note in your story, which is called Look Who's Rockin' the Casbah, you say that sex may be the most immediately striking aspect of these productions, but it is the least important aspect of their revolutionary potential. Will you explain why?
Yes. If they have a revolutionary potential, and I believe that they do, it actually lies in imagining yourself on your own terms, as opposed to accepting an identity that you were born into.
Yes, you talk about men in these videos shown as Arab cowboys and easy riders and truck drivers and medieval countesses in castles and science fiction Arabs battling aliens and a whole host of other images that they probably have never applied to themselves before.
That's right. These videos are actually presenting a huge range of new ways of being, and especially new ways of being an Arab. Now, some of these are perfectly plausible roles, and some of these are complete fantasy roles. But the point is that these are narratives that offer tools for imagining yourself on your own terms. And I argue in the piece that that's actually an extremely basic aspect of what we consider modernity in the West, by which I don't mean to say that contemporary Islamic culture lacks modernity, but this is one particular element that continues to be a powerful source of tension in much of the Arab world. And these kinds of disposable cultural artifacts are extremely useful to audiences in trying to deal with that tension about making themselves into whoever it is they want to be.
You also observe in your story that what may yet work in the region is what has worked elsewhere for centuries, commercialism that does not transmit a regime's utopian dreams, but addresses the personal dreams of the audience. This is getting people where they live, you think?
Yes, it is. The Mideast has had a long series of isms that have been tried, Arab Marxism, Pan-Arabism. Islamism is in the air now and in other forms has been in the past. None of these things have worked, and some of them have failed really quite disastrously. Now, the reason that something like this has worked is that this ism, commercialism in this case, consumerism, people are using things, artifacts, in this case it's videos, based on the meaning that they find in them. They're not a force presented by the state or by a political party or by of some philosophical or religious movement. And the meaning that these things have for individuals changes from individual to individual. And that's really where the power of these things has been in the past, and that's their latent power as they play out in the Middle East as well.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Charles Paul Freund is senior editor of Reason Magazine.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball and Blake Carlton. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Good night, everybody.
See you next week.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John D. and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.